Cautiously, I began to feel my limbs, my arms, my body, my feet, my fingers. They were all there, untouched. The whole truth dawned upon me. My God, I was alive. I sat up in my bed. I wanted to shout and dance for joy. There was a bandage round my head. I was blind. Yes, I knew that, but there was nothing really the matter with me except that. The mere fact of being only blind seemed, in comparison, a luxury. I was blind, but joy indescribable. What was that triviality? I was alive, alive. Oh my, I never knew before that life was so wonderful. Did other people understand what life was? No, you must be dead to understand what life was worth. I must tell everyone how wonderful it is. Those are the words spoken by a captain in the London Rifle Brigade, the 1st 5th Battalion, a man called Captain Gilbert Norris. And last week, by accident really, I found his book that he called On the Right Side of the British Line, that he'd written in, I think, the 1920s, and I found it online. And as I started to read through the 240 pages, I soon realised that this was to be no ordinary book. I've read many memoirs from the First World War, but this particular one struck me because of his remarkable attitude to being blinded. Then I thought, well, maybe he was temporarily blinded. But as I read on, I realised that this blinding that he'd encountered was permanent. And how had it happened? He'd been shot in the head. The bullet had entered his head through his temple and exited through his eyeball. How on earth did he survive that terrible wounding on the Somme in September of 1916? So welcome to another edition of the podcast that I, Terry Wenham, called Tales from the Battlefield. And this week it really is a tale from the battlefield, when, as I just said, we're going to follow the story from enlistment through to the end of his life, Gilbert Nobbs of the London Rifle Brigade. Where do you start? Well, let's just have a look at a summary of this man's life and his war record. When Gilbert was wounded on the 9th of September 1916, he had served the military for 12 years and was therefore a regular soldier. He served as a private and a non-commissioned officer in the London Rifle Brigade. And after his initial service before the First World War, he moved to Canada and he became a general manager. And he also served in the army in Canada as well. And then in 1914, he was offered a directorship in a Canadian firm, but decided to return to England. And when war broke out in August 1914, he was offered and accepted a commission in the London Rifle Brigade. But it wasn't until August 1916 that he travelled out to the Western Front. And although they'd spent a brief time in the trenches, his life was to change on the night of the 8th and the 9th of September 1916. His unit was on the extreme right of the British Army as they attacked a wood that was forever to become known as Lousy Wood, and for very good reason as well. And it was there that he was shot blind. He fell into a shell hole and he sat there for over 2 days, when eventually he was discovered by Germans who dragged him into a trench. He was then taken to several hospitals in Germany and finally to one in Hanover, which was a hospital for wounded officers and German soldiers that were in fact suffering from venereal disease. He wasn't, of course. There he remained for 7 weeks, but his eyesight had gone. And next he was sent for a month to a prison camp in a place called Osnabrück. His next journey was to appear before the Swiss Commission, who on account of the loss of his sight passed him for exchange. And this was happening on a regular basis, organised by the Red Cross in Switzerland. Badly wounded prisoners were exchanged between the Allies and Germany. He was then taken to the Hook of Holland via Liège, Brussels and Antwerp, and he finally arrived home at the end of 1916. But believe me, that's far from the end of his story. When the war ended, he emigrated with his wife, who was called Catherine, and they went to Australia, and he threw himself into work for them at a company called Holbrooks, the same company that he worked for in Canada. He became the managing director of the company and he travelled widely on their behalf. And in the 1930s, he was fond of saying that his teddy bear, which always went with him, had travelled more than 500,000 miles. He actually transformed the company into one of the largest employers in Australia. And he went to live in the beautiful suburb in Sydney called Manly and became involved with the swimming club there for many years. He became the vice president in 1922 and was made a life member of the club in 1935. And he was also involved with the local rugby union club as well, and he became the chairman of the New South Wales Blinded Soldiers Association. He was awarded the OBE in the New Year's Honours of 1951 for his years of service to these and to many other causes as well. In 1965, he and Catherine celebrated their diamond wedding anniversary, and he died aged 90 in 1970, 54 years after his death had first been reported and after he'd been blinded by that gunshot on the Somme. Now, I think I may have said earlier that Gilbert's book was published in the 1920s. Well, I was wrong, it wasn't. Looking at the front of the book now, it was actually published in New York as early as September 1917. And at the beginning of the book, we get an insight into the sort of man that Gilbert was, because he says, besides the man who fights, there is a woman who waits, and in humble tribute to her silent heroism, I dedicate this book. And in the preface, he says, this is my first book and it's also my last, but I have a record to make and a duty to perform. I was 5 weeks on the firing line, 4 weeks mourned as dead, and 3 months a prisoner of war. I've attempted to make a true record of all that happened. The names alone are fictitious. I do not deplore the loss of my sight, for I can say in all sincerity that I was never happier in my life than I am today. And I think that's what first made me realise that this book was going to be like none other that I've read. How could you possibly feel like that? How could you possibly say that despite knowing that for the rest of your life, you're never going to be able to see the sights that you got so used to. You're never going to be able to see the trees or the sunshine or his wife's face. How does one cope with those sort of feelings? But he does, and he goes on to explain in more detail later in the book, which I'm going to share with you today. It really is beyond my comprehension. And then we get more evidence of how he feels about the women that have been left behind, and he's no doubt thinking about his own wife Catherine, who he'd married in 1905. He says, who are the true heroes of the war? Our fighting men are cheered in the streets. Every newspaper and magazine sings their praises. Every shop window reflects their needs. In theatre, pulpit and workshop, their praises are sung. But who are the real heroes? Ask the fighting man himself. Speak to him of his wife or mother, and the expression on his face will answer your question. There is no one to sing her praise, no one to paint the picture of her deeds, no one to tell of that lonely feeling when her hero departs and the door is closed behind him. The fighting man looks upon his share of the war with a light heart. He does not feel the gnawing hunger of the lonely wait, the emptiness of the world when the parting is over, the empty chair at the table and the rooms made cheerless by his absence. There is no one to describe the terrors of the morning casualty list, the hourly expectation and frozen fear of the telegraph boys, rat-tat, bringing some dreadful news. There are no crowds to cheer her, no flags or trumpets to rouse her enthusiasm and occupy her thoughts, no constant activity, thrilling excitement and desperate encounter. Hers is a silent patriotism. She is the true hero of the war, and in the hundreds of thousands of homes throughout the empire, her silent deeds, her wonderful fortitude, and making the womanhood of Britain a history which medals will not reward nor scars display. The fighting men know it, and when you cheer them, you know there's still one at home who deserves your cheers. Yet you will not hear them, and you will seek no greater reward than the safe return of our own hero amid the applause which greets their homecoming. Fighting men acknowledge it, and when your ears are no longer deafened by the cheers of others, take off your caps, fill your lungs and cheer to the echo of the real heroes of the war. All honour to the woman who waits. rarely hear that, do you? I don't think I've ever read that before, about a man who was so seriously wounded in the war, thinking about not just his own wife, but all those other mothers and loved ones and wives waiting at home anxiously, getting on with their work of looking after the rest of their family, doing all those chores that took so much physical effort in this time in history. This was before the automatic washing machine and all those other mod cons that make life relatively easy for families today. No, they didn't have any of that. But the woman in both world wars continued with those chores, continued looking after the children and all the other relatives, whilst anxiously waiting for news from the front line, which in so many cases turned out to be the worst possible news. How on earth did that generation cope? This is something I ask myself over and over again, not just the men, but as Gilbert points out here, the women folk as well. Keep the home fires burning, while your hearts are yearning, though your lands are far away, they dream of home. There's a silver lining through the dark cloud shining. And then Gilbert talks about actually departing London at Waterloo Station. Waterloo Station is one of those hubs in London that I've used a lot during my business career. I used to pass through there once a week. As I read his words, he says, "The scene is inspiring, depressing, historical. Hear the noise and the babble of the throng, the sobs and the cheers, the last look, the last handshake, the cheery greeting, and the boyish laughter. Whilst out in the street, London continues its unaltered ways, indifferent to the greatest war in the world's history, reflected within a stone throw in Waterloo Station. Porters were hurrying backward and forward, trying to find seats for late arrivals. Women were sobbing, men were talking earnestly. Presently, the shrill whistle of the guard, the hurried farewells, spontaneous cheers, and the slowly moving train gradually left the station, carrying its human freight to an unknown destiny." That really did make me think about those times that I used to go through Waterloo Station, hurrying from my tube to get the connection down to Guildford, my destination. And the scene would have been the same, but very different, wouldn't it? I was travelling on a modern train. He was travelling on a steam train. I wonder whether there were any fast food outlets, because around me were outlets selling burgers, cakes, pastries. People were rushing in out of Marks and Spencer's, purchasing their sandwiches for the day ahead. That wouldn't have been there, would it, that day? There would have been the same babble, as he calls it. But as people rushed around Waterloo Station in the 21st century, they weren't waving goodbye to relatives on their way to war. They were looking at their phone. They were calling people. They were making arrangements for dinner that evening. They were looking at the internet. They were surrounded by electronic adverts, selling stuff that you had to go on the internet to buy. The building was the same at Waterloo Station. Deep down, those people were the same. But their experiences, their feelings, their thoughts, and their worries about the future would have been very, very different. I don't know, but perhaps as they left Waterloo Station, they sang songs just like this one.
Brother Bucky went away to do his bit the other day, with a smile on his lips and his left hand and pips upon his shoulder, bright and gay. As the train moved out, he said, "Remember me to all the birds." Then he wagged his paw and went away to war, shouting out these pathetic words. "Goodbye, goodbye, wipe the tear, baby dear, from your eye. Though it's hard to part, I know. I'll be tickled to death to go. Don't cry, don't sigh,
there's a silver lining in the sky. Bonsoir, old thing, cheerio, chin chin, naku, toodaloo, goodbye.
He then talks about the next stage of his journey, that crossing of the English Channel. And this is something that I've done three times in the last month or so, as I've headed over to the battlefields of Normandy and of the Somme and Ypres. We travelled in the same way, in the same route that Gilbert did all those years ago. And whenever we go down to Dover to catch our ferry, and people are rushing off the coach to go and get some food and to stretch their legs after the long journey down there, I always say to them as we leave the harbour, look back at those white cliffs of Dover, and just imagine that you're a soldier crossing the Channel in either of the Great Wars, and wonder how many of those thought to themselves what was to become of them. And we can get some evidence of that from Gilbert. Of course, what I always say to people, we know that 3 or 4 days later we'll be returning, we'll see those white cliffs again, and we'll be returning to our loved ones. But what did Gilbert think? He said the sea was calm and a full moon cast a silvery, shimmering pathway across the water. All lights on board the troop ship were extinguished, and with black smoke belching from the funnels and the vibrations of the engines trembling through the ship, we made our dash, as he calls it, across the Channel. And then he talks about the warships that are giving them protection from U-boats as they make their way across the Channel. He says, who but those whose duty is to perform the arduous task of protecting our troop ships can understand and appreciate what it means to live the life of a sailor on those comfortless looking destroyers, night after night, week after week, throughout the years, tearing frantically up and down, seeking a hidden foe, daring the treacherous minds, safeguarding their trust with apparent disregard for their own safety. The men who perform such duties are hidden heroes, and the safe transportation of our fighting millions across the sea is a silent tribute of their bravery. So, a bit like the women that he's talking about, forgotten heroes, he's talking about those sailors on the destroyers that no doubt did save many lives, and how many of those gave up their own lives. And it's something that I've not thought about before, and I'm sure lots of other people haven't. I've not heard them talked about on any of the TV programmes or podcasts or read about them in books. I'm sure the story's out there, it's just that I haven't seen them. He goes on, he says, this work goes on and will go on until the end of the war, and the men who perform this great task do so with the knowledge that only failure can bring their names before the public. He then talks about meeting friends on board and making several new friends. He says, but one man in particular attracted my attention, and his appearance seemed so strangely out of place with the surroundings. Sitting with a bored expression on his face was a young man in his 30s, in a brand new uniform with a single star on his shoulder strap, which proclaimed him to the world as a second lieutenant. He was rather tubby in appearance, with a round, chubby face, which was screwed up in a frantic effort to retain within its grasp a monocle through which he viewed his fellow beings in mute astonishment. And what is more, he wore new kid gloves. It was Septimus Darcy, dressed in immaculate neatness, radiating the atmosphere of Bond Street, indifferent to everybody, yet with a horrified look of discomfort at finding himself in such unusual surroundings. Now, this man, Septimus, that he's described there is quite a character, obviously, and he comes from a different world to many of those private soldiers and NCOs on board. His place in society has earned him the rank of second lieutenant, a junior officer. And you think on the face of it that he wasn't going to be a good fighting man. And in the next half the book, really, Gilbert almost teases him, takes the mickey out of him, I suppose, about that upper class behaviour and dress sense of Septimus. But his opinion of him was to change, as we'll see. I've tried to find Septimus online, but he's already told us, as Gilbert, at the beginning of the book, that the names are fictitious. The man he describes does exist, but we'll never know who he was because he gave him a fictitious name. He says, we walked along the deck, and to my embarrassment, a few minutes later, I found myself shaking the limp paw of Septimus Darcy, glove and all. I said to him, we're having a very pleasant crossing. Yes, he drawled, but a damned overcrowded one, what? I suppose so, but troop ships are always overcrowded. I say, though, where does one sleep? Septimus said. I rather suspected that what Septimus really wanted to know was whether there was such thing as a private cabin. I replied to him, there seems to be two places to sleep, either in the boiler room or on deck. On deck, Septimus said. Rather uncomfortable, what? Septimus doesn't take up his invitation. Gilbert goes and unpacks his kit and gets into his sleeping bag on deck. And he says the scene was a very inspiring one, and I could not help dreaming of the future. What had destiny in store for us? Who would return in glory? And who would be called upon to pay the great price, to come back bleeding and disabled, dependent for future existence upon the benevolence of a nation's gratitude? The ship sped forward, carrying its human freight. Greater and greater grew the distance from loved ones behind. Nearer and nearer we sped towards the unknown future. And you can imagine, can't you, that every single man that crossed the channel in the same way, my great uncle, my grandfather, one came back, one didn't, your relatives, other people that we've talked about on this podcast, all those lads whose headstones that we look at in the cemeteries, all those names on the memorials at Arras, Teepvale, Vimy Ridge, Meningate, and so on and so on, would have all had those same thoughts. He even recognises that in the next paragraph. He says, how many of those lying around, silent companions of their thoughts, were thinking the same as I? What was the future? Horror, anxiety, success, failure, mutilation, death. Which was it to be? And what a change this was to the times we'd had in the past. Of course, the one thing he doesn't say there, he doesn't fear being blinded. That hadn't occurred to him, had it? But that was exactly what was to happen. He says we're all civilian soldiers, lawyers, merchants, bankers and tradesmen. Fighting was not our profession nor desire. Finally, he manages to get some rest. He says my cigarette was finished and I was becoming sleepy. I turned over to settle myself comfortably and turning my eyes in the direction of the companionway, I saw the tubby figure of an officer standing near the rail, immaculately dressed and in strange contrast to his surroundings. It was Septimus Darcy. Immaculate and indifferent. Septimus was at war, but Septimus was still in Bond Street. And what I think he's saying there is that he's dressed for war, he's heading for war, but like all the other men on board, Septimus had no idea what was ahead of him. His attitude, his thoughts were still at home in the world that he knew, a world which was never going to be the same again for either of these two men from very different backgrounds. He talks about Septimus again once they arrive in France and are initially billeted in a hotel. And he says, turning into one of the side streets, we beheld the immortal Septimus, looking like one who's hopelessly lost in the middle of the Sahara Desert. Now, Septimus was not a born soldier and he had made no attempt to carry his equipment on his back, so his equipment lay on the pavement beside him. He'd evidently dragged it some little distance and looked upon it as a beastly nuisance and standing there vainly hoping that a taxi would come to his rescue and help him carry the beastly thing away. We gave Septimus a lift and he evidently needed looking after. Arriving at the hotel, we all tumbled into the dining room for breakfast, all except Septimus, who made straight for the nearest bar and was last heard of on that day tapping a coin vigorously on the counter, frantically screeching for a whiskey and soda. Well, we're now going to fast forward in the book and we next find Gilbert arriving on the Somme battlefield during August. And by this time, the Battle of the Somme had moved forward. Trones Wood had been taken a few weeks earlier, but there was still the debris and the dead lying around. And this is how he described it. We struggled across a sea of shell holes and we arrived at Death Valley and halted by Trones Wood. Here, hundreds of our guns were massed, wheel to wheel and row upon row, and every gun was being worked as hard as possible. As darkness came on, the roar of the guns was accentuated by the flash of the discharge. We did not speak, for speaking without other question. The noise was too terrific, and we lay on the ground silenced by wonder and bewilderment. And then he talks about their progress as they get closer and closer to the front line. Late that evening, orders came to move into the trenches on the far slope of the Valley of Death. Trenches here, trenches there, trenches everywhere. while we groped around without knowing where the trenches led to or the position of the German lines. We spent an anxious night, the uncertainty of our position and mystery of those mass guns thundering their wrath into the darkness of the night. It caused a tension which defied any desire to sleep. What was the meaning of it all? What was happening over yonder, where the iron of England's anger was falling, bursting, tearing, killing? What was happening over there? Would we receive a similar reply? The signs were significant. We were at last on the Somme. We were in it with a vengeance. And then over the next few hours, they moved up from the area of Trones Wood, the short distance to what was to become known as Lousy Wood, one of two woods that sits in front of the small town or the large village of Combles, or Comblay, I think the French call it. And it was Lousy Wood that was to play the major part in the rest of his short time on the Somme battlefield. But before all that, he meets his old mate again, Septimus Darcy, the man from Bond Street, as he called him. He says there he was, with his monocle riveted in his right eye, between the frown of his eyebrow and the chubby fatness of his cheek, with the bored expression of one who saw no reason for the necessity of the fatigue which caused the undignified beads of perspiration to assemble on an otherwise unruffled countenance. And he recalls his conversation with him, and it's a conversation that I can quote now. "Hello, Septimus," I said, as he came along, dragging his things behind him. "Ah, hello, well, I'll be damned. Never expect to find you here. Awfully glad to meet you again. What are you doing here? I'll be damned if I know. Uninteresting spot, this, what? Well, what have you come here for?" "Nothing much. I saw a fellow in that big dugout in the valley, and he told me to report to you. The fact is, you know, you're attached to me, or I'm attached to you, or something of that sort." "I must tell you, Captain, I'm horribly fatigued," said Septimus. "I came through the guns, very interested in all that, but it made my head ache. I said to him, 'Have some water, it's rather muddy, but better than nothing these days.' 'No, thanks. Doctor warned me against drinking dirty water, dysentery and all that, don't you know? Have you got any whiskey and soda?'" He then warned Septimus that now he was on the battlefield, he must drop all that nonsense. Septimus replied, "All right, old thing, I rather doubted the soda, but thank heaven I've got a flask, a sort of emergency ratten. Help yourself and let's drink it neat." The way he's describing it, Septimus, with his upper-class background, seems to think, although he's in the middle of one of the worst battles in history, he's still living life as though he's in Belgravia in London or Bond Street. He still thinks he's perhaps at Eton or Harrow. He's acting as though he's not on the Western Front at all. But I think it was an act. He knew exactly where he was. He knew exactly what he'd got to do. And we're going to see evidence of that very, very soon. Gilbert goes on to explain what was in the pack that Septimus was carrying. He said, "I've never seen in all my life such a lot of rubbish in the war kit of a soldier. There seemed to be nothing he'd really need, but a curious mixture of strange articles that would fill a fancy bazaar. There were hairbrushes with ebony backs and silver monograms, silk handkerchiefs with fancy borders, a pinky toothpaste oozing out of a leaden tube and crushed between a comb and a pair of silk socks, a large bottle of reddish toothwash, sufficient to last him 3 years, half of which had leaked through the cork to the destruction of about a dozen silk handkerchiefs. There was a box of cigars, a heavy china pot of massage cream, a leather writing case, a large ivory-backed mirror, which had lost its usefulness forever, a bottle of fountain pen ink, two suits of silk pyjamas, one striped with pink and the other blue, a huge bath towel, a case containing 7 razors, one for each day in the week, with a sponge as big as his head. Poor Septimus, in his simplicity and ignorance, for the first time in his life, he'd packed his own kit. Battalion then moved their way up through the Valley of Death. As they moved towards their positions, Gilbert says, where the bodies of friend and foe lay side by side or clutched in a desperate embrace, he said it found the line where the fury of nations found his expression, like the scar of a devil's vengeance. "As I looked on the bodies of the dead, twisted and mutilated, limbless and torn, some half buried in debris, here and there lying doubled in unnatural positions, while others yet seemed to be clutching at some mortal wound. I felt like one who fearfully treads into the vortex of Dante's Inferno. Yet this was the devil's own hell, but a hell far more dreadful than I ever imagined it to be. Speaks for itself, really. It's much worse than he imagined it to be. How could they have imagined before they arrived on the Somme what it was going to be like? How can we imagine over 100 years later what it was like? The only thing we can do is to listen to their accounts, to read their accounts, to visit the battlefield ourselves and just try and imagine. But unless you were there, it's impossible, isn't it? He continues by describing the feelings and what he saw the first time he saw Lousy Wood. He says there, straight in front, could be faintly seen the trench formed in the shape of a square, and left of it, Lousy Wood. But what were those peculiar stumps to the left of our trenches? They looked like the remains of a corpse which had been shelled until only the stumps of a few trees remained. But that was Falfremont Farm. Falfremont Farm was supposed to be their headquarters, but there was nothing there. It had been bombed out of existence. And it had been the scene of heavy fighting before they arrived. He says there was no sign of it anywhere. I was not sure of my position on the map. It was puzzling. After asking a French officer for more information, he says I went back to my trench. I didn't like the look of things. If Falfremont Farm had got blown to smithereens like that, what chance did I stand? Phew, I was getting the wind up. That's probably an understatement, isn't it? This is not a professional soldier. He's a businessman by trade. And like he said earlier on, he's got tailors, porters, shopkeepers, architects and all sorts of other professional men in his battalion. But here they were, in hell. And it was hell that was going to get much, much worse in the next few hours for so many of them. And then he received his orders for their objectives. He was told, you'll dig in tonight, and tomorrow we're going to take that trench that's formed like a square to prepare the way for a frontal attack on Combourg by the French. But first of all, they had to get to their jumping off positions, and that was to be another challenge. He said time was getting on. I gave orders for the men to dress and lie flat on the parados, ready for the word to move. When all preparations were completed and bombs, picks and shovels issued to each man, I signalled the advance. With a few scouts in front and on the flanks, we slowly moved in single file into the unknown. It was a pitch black night, intensified by a slight fog, and I took my direction by compass bearing, wondering all the while if it would lead me right. The men marched in silence. Nothing could be heard but the muffled footsteps over the soft ground and the occasional jingling of a spade or pick against the butt of a rifle. Distance became exaggerated and 50 paces seemed like 500, until I began to get a horrible fear that my compass has misled me and that countless German eyes were watching me leading my men into the midst of their guns. Where were we going? When will we get back and how many of us? It's a devilishly creepy feeling. And when at last I found myself close to the edge of wood, I felt as though I was arriving home. But the real job had not yet begun. He then talks about when they reached their jumping off position, giving orders to the men to dig in, and the men complaining because the ground was hard and it was chalky. And they started to slowly dig in, but then a green light went up, falling in our direction. Every man stopped work and looked up in amazement. Dig like hell, I whispered hoarsely, hurrying along the line of wondering men. But they wanted no urging this time, and every man set to work with feverish energy. And then the bombardment commenced, and in a few minutes the air was filled with whistling shells, screeching through the night and making the darkness hideous. We were only a foot below the surface of the ground. Once again, I hastened along the line. Dig like hell, I shouted. Lights were going up in rapid succession, and the German line whence they came appeared only a couple of hundred yards in front and seemed to form a semicircle around my left flank. The bombardment stopped and they expected the Germans to attack. And he wondered whether it would be a sudden rush, a desperate hand-to-hand fight. And then, what then, he says. The minutes passed like hours in an agony of suspense. But then he was in for a surprise because he met his old friend Septimus once again. He said the bombardment was continuing and he made his plans for the attack tomorrow. And a few minutes later, I chanced to notice a figure sitting leisurely in a shell hole. "Why, Septimus, is that you?" Septimus replies, "I think so, I say, I think so. Unearthly row, devilishly dangerous place this, what? But what are you doing in there? I was just coming to talk to you about ammunition. A shell burst and my face is simply covered with dust. Has the ammunition arrived yet?" "No," I told him, "there's an ammunition dump in the woods somewhere." And Septimus, it amazes him then. This is this upper class twit almost. He says, "Like me to go and find it?" I looked at him in amazement. Was it possible that dear old Septimus, this bland, indifferent, tubby, blasé old thing of Bond Street, was anxious to go into that creepy, mysterious wood to look for ammunition? I said to him, "All right, take a corporal and 12 men and bring back 6 boxes. Don't take unnecessary risks, because we're going to need every man tomorrow." Septimus then sprang out of the shell hole, saluted in the most correct manner, something that was quite new for him, and disappeared into the darkness. This was a new side of Septimus's character which had not shown itself before. Only the stoutest heart would have chosen to wander about in that wood at midnight with enemy patrols lurking about. 5 minutes later, he passed me, leading his men. He gripped my hand as he passed with the remark, "Well, ta-ta, I'll think." "Cheerio," I said to him, and Septimus was gone. So at this stage, it occurs to me and to Gilbert that Septimus was no fool. He was, despite his behaviour, a very brave man, committed to helping his mates. Gilbert says, "We may call men fops, simple vacant fools, or what we like, but the war has proved over and over again that the man within the man is merely disguised by his outer covering. Many a Bond Street algae or ballroom idol has proved, amidst the terrors of war, that the artificial covering of peacetime habit is but skin deep, and the real man is underneath." As I sit here reading that, I realise that heroes come from all walks of life, don't they? So how did Septimus get on in that wood looking for the ammunition? Well, Gilbert tells us, he said, "All of a sudden I was startled by a rattle of musketry in the direction of the wood. There was silence, then several more shots followed by a rushing, tearing noise and yells. Almost at the same moment, the ammunition party emerged breathlessly from the wood. I ran forward to where the men were dropping the ammo boxes on the ground and falling exhausted. For a moment or two, they were too breathless to speak. I counted the men. There were 12 of them, and the 6 boxes of ammunition had arrived safely." If you remember, 12 men had been given to Septimus to go into the wood to find that ammunition. 12 men plus Septimus and a corporal. "All was silent in the wood," he says. "I turned to the nearest man, who was by this time sitting up, holding his head in his hands. 'Where is Mr. Darcy and Corporal Brown?' I asked. 'God knows, sir. They stayed to cover our retirement.' 'What happened?' The man replied, 'We found the ammunition dump, sir, and were just beginning to move the boxes when we heard someone moving. We grabbed our rifles and waited. There seemed to be quite a number of crawling around us. Mr. Darcy ordered us to retire at once and get the ammunition away at any cost. He said he would stay behind and cover our retreat, and Corporal Brown offered to stay with him. We hadn't got far, sir, when they opened fire. Bullets hit the trees and whizzed over our heads. Then we heard a rush and some yells. I distinctly heard something in German, and Mr. Darcy's voice shout back, 'Kamerade, be damned!' There was a scuffle, that's all I know." Gilbert says that his heart was beating wildly as he listened to the story. "Good God," he thought to himself, "what did the silence mean? There was no further time to be lost." He says he ordered a relief party and led the way into the wood. There was not a sound to be heard as we crept forward on our hands and knees towards the spot where the ammunition had been found. "What was that?" We listened breathlessly, and again we heard a low groan, almost in our midst. There was a shell hole just in front, and crawling along on all fours, I found Septimus Darcy, wounded and helpless, with his left leg almost blown away and bleeding from the head. "What's up, Darcy? What has happened?" I whispered hoarsely. A faint smile of recognition came over his pale face as I supported him in my arms, and his words came back painfully. "The ammunition, sir. Is it safe?" "Yes, quite safe. But what happened after they left?" Septimus replied, "I stayed behind with the corporal to protect the retirement. We opened rapid fire to draw German fire on us. I saw six creeping forward. They called to us to surrender. I refused, damn them. They threw bombs, killed the corporal, the dirty dogs. Smashed my leg, nothing much. I picked off three with my revolver. I've never used the beastly thing before. Two bolted, and the last one jumped at me with bayonet. That's him there. Just got him, last cartridge. Septimus was lying heavily in my arms. Nothing could be done for him. I saw the end was at hand. Goodbye, Captain. Knew you'd come. Don't know much about soldiering. Good sport. Shan't have to carry that. Damned pack again. A placid smile came over his chubby face as he gasped out the last words. His monocle was still firmly fixed between his fat cheek and his eyebrow. Once more he seemed indifferent to his surroundings. In front of him, the silent evidence of his plucky stand were the dead bodies of four Germans. By his side lay a revolver. I picked up and examined the chamber. The last cartridge had been fired. The men had gathered around. The caps were off. Septimus seemed to be looking up smilingly into their faces. Septimus was dead. But Septimus was still in Bond Street. Now, after that, instinctively, I spent 10 minutes trying to find out who Septimus was, searching his name in all sorts of different combinations on the Commonwealth War Graves Commission website. But then I remembered, these are fictitious names, not fictitious characters. But Gilbert had changed the names of these men. We'll never know who Septimus was, but we do know that he was a very, very brave man. And he gave his life so that his lads could be saved. And this was his first day in action, don't forget. And as he said, he didn't really take to soldiering, did he? So we then had to go over the top, not long afterwards, feeling the pain of losing someone he'd obviously become very close to in such a short space of time. But the show had to go on, didn't it? He then received a major setback when orders came down from headquarters that the plan had been changed, and they were to go into action almost immediately with no further preparation. The men are now lined up, ready to go over the parapet. And then he saw something that horrified him, that made him realise what they were in for. He says, at last, feeling something was wrong and unable to restrain my impatience any longer, I jumped out of the trench and ran along the parados. The parados is the back of the trench. What I saw there appalled me for the moment. The wood in front of me was filled with bursting shells. Bullets were whistling in all directions. Good God, what a hell. No wonder the men hesitated. What was to be done? My orders left me no alternative. I must advance through the wood. My brain kept repeating the words, at any cost. What a cost it would be to enter that hell. It was now or never. We were hesitating. Something must be done and done quickly. I looked at Farman and I knew I could count on him. The next moment I leapt into a newly made shell hole about 5 yards in the wood. I called upon Farman to follow and a moment later he came jumping after. The noise was terrific. We yelled at the top of our voices for the next man to follow. By this time the scene inside the wood was indescribable. Machine gun bullets were spraying backward and forward. 6-inch shells were exploding in all directions. And the din was intensified by the crashing of trees uprooted by the explosions and the dull thud of the missiles striking the ground. Through the dull light of that filthy wood, we frequently cast an anxious glance towards the red rockets being sent up from the German lines, directing the fire of their artillery towards us. Sometimes, in leaping forward, we would land beside the dead and mutilated carcass of a German soldier who'd fallen a week before. It was ghastly, terrible, and the millions of flies sucking at his open wounds would swarm about us, seemingly in a buzz of anger at our disturbance. But sickly and ghastly as the scene was, farther and farther into this exaggerated hell we must go. But incredibly, they're still not at their jumping-off position. And as he moves forward to get ready to the attack, he thinks of England and how peaceful England must be at this moment, how pretty the village is, and how wicked this hell seemed in front of us. And these were the men of England, nice chaps, only territorials. One used to meet them in the city every day. Some were awful nuts, seen them at lunch. Watched them pouring out of Liverpool Street Station between 9 and 10 in the morning with newspaper and walking stick. See them in the banks, bending over ledgers. You could hardly believe it, but these were the same men. Fighting was never their profession, What will England think of this? England may never know. Who had heard of Lousy Wood before? If a man is killed in England, there is an inquest. People read about it in the papers. Other people left behind in England suffering hardships uncomplainingly and gritting their teeth like you are. You're only getting a bob a day. England needs you. He is, of course, talking as he writes in his book to his men. But finally, the time has come for them to go over the top and walk into no man's land, through the wood and towards the Germans a couple of hundred yards away. Zero hour has arrived, he says. The barrage had begun, meaning the British barrage to support them. Number 6 platoon will advance. He says the line was perfect. The tut-tut-tut of machine guns developed from several parts of the square, while the crack of rifles increased in intensity. So thinking about this, having read it again, what they've done is moved up through the ruins of the wood, which had been taken the previous week, and they're now attacking German trenches on the other side of the wood. They're coming out of the wood and into the open, and it's dawn. He says, what happened next beggars description. As I write these lines, my hand hesitates to describe the hell that was let loose upon those men. No eye but mine could take in the picture so completely. Will the world ever know what these men faced and fought against? These men of the City of London. Not unless I tell it, for I alone saw all that happened that day, and my hand alone, weak and incapable though it feels, is the only one that can do it. Barely had I emerged from the wood with my 10 runners when a perfect hurricane of shells was hurled at us, machine guns from several points spraying their deadly fire backward and forward, dropping men like corn before the reaper. From all sides of the square, a hurricane of fire was poured into the centre of the square upon us as we emerged from the wood. In far less time than it takes to record it, the attacking waves became a mere sprinkling of men. They went on for a yard or two, and then all seemed to vanish. Even my runners, who'd extended into line, were dropping fast. Again and again the line was thinned, and again the survivors, undaunted and unbeaten, reformed and pressed forward. Men laughed, men cried in the desperation of the moment. We were grappling with death. We were dodging it, cheating it. We were mad, blindly hysterical. What did anything matter? Farther and farther into the inferno we must press at any cost, at any cost. Leaping, jumping, rushing, we went from shell hole to shell hole, and still the fire continued with unrelenting fury. I jumped into a shell hole and found myself within 10 yards of my objective. My 3 remaining runners jumped in alongside of me. Arnold, Dobson and Wilkinson. Arnold was done for. He looked up at me with eyes staring and face blanched and panted out that he could go no further, and I realised I could count on him no more. He then realised that the company on his left had completely disappeared and the trench just a few yards in front of him was still occupied by the Germans, or the Boche as he called them. He wondered where the supports were. He says anxiously, I glanced back towards the wood. Why did they not come? What he didn't know. And what he writes is that those poor fellows, the hand of death had dealt with them even more heavily in the wood than it had with us. My position was desperate. I could not retire. My orders were imperative. You must reach your objective at any cost. I must get there somehow. But even if we get there, how long could I hope to hold out with such a few handful of men? And still, as I read those words, this is the third time I've read those words. In my own mind, I'm thinking, these men are territorials, weekend soldiers. They'd been used to practicing. This was their first day in action. They were bankers, architects, businessmen. And here they were in a storm that none of them could have anticipated. And with those thoughts in his mind that they must achieve the objective, he decides to go forward. He started off with about 200 men in the company that he was commanding. And he says that they were down to just about 7 or 8 men. He says he noticed that the Germans in the trench in front were running away along the trench. And he says it was now or never. We must charge over that strip of land and finish them with a bayonet. The trench in front must be taken by assault. It must be done. There were 6 or 7 of us left and we must do it. I yelled to the men, get ready to charge. They're running. Come on, come on. I jumped out of the shell hole and they followed me. Once again, I was mad. I saw nothing, I heard nothing. I wanted to kill, kill. But what happened next was to shape the next 54 years of Gilbert's life. A fraction of a second was to mean that those Germans running away, that shell hole and that exposed German trench were the last things that he would ever see. He says, oh my God, I was hit in the head. I was blind. He says, I was wounded, I was blind. But the moments that followed are clear in my memory. The brain, shocked by a blow, works quickly and actively in its excited effort to hold its own. I was quite conscious and thinking clearly. I knew what had happened and what would happen. I remembered every detail. He said a bullet had entered my left temple. It must have come from a sniper at that strong point that was 50 yards away. The bullet had passed clean through my head. I thought it had emerged from my right temple. I was mistaken, for I found out some days later that it had emerged through the centre of my right eye. I remember distinctly clutching my head and sinking to the ground, and all the time I was thinking, so this is the end. The finish of it all, shot through the head, mine is a fatal wound. I was blind, as I am now, but the blackness, which was then before me, underwent a change. A voice from somewhere behind me said, this is death, will you come? Then gradually the blackness became more intense. A curtain seemed to be slowly falling. There was space, there was darkness, blacker than my blindness, everything was past. There was a peacefulness, a nothingness, but a happiness that was indescribable. I seemed for a moment somewhere in the emptiness, looking down at my body, lying in a shell hole, bleeding from the temple. I was dead, and that was my body, but I was happy. What he's describing there is what's known as a near-death experience. And many people that have been close to death have told the same story. There's no scientific explanation for this. I once thought that perhaps it was the drugs that were given to people that were dying of disease. But in this case, he hadn't taken any drugs. There was no one to give him any morphine at this stage. This was just moments after he'd been hit. He then goes on to say that effectively he chose not to die. He says, but the voice I'd heard seemed to be waiting for an answer. I seemed to exert myself by a frantic effort, like one in a dream who's trying to awaken. I said to myself, no, not now, I won't die. Then the curtain slowly lifted, my body moved and I was moving. I was alive. Call it an hallucination, a trick of the brain or what you will. I make no attempt to influence you. I merely record the incident. But my own belief I'll keep to myself. Whatever it was, I no longer feel there is any mystery about death, nor do I dread it. Now remember the man that he called Arnold and said that he was done for? Well, he wasn't, because he tried to find his way back to the British lines, and he stumbled in and out of shell holes and was eventually captured by the Germans, and he told his captors that I was lying out, I being Gilbert, in no man's land, and begged them to send medical aid. And they told him that stretcher bearers would be sent to make a search. And that's what happened. He tried to crawl out of the shell hole that he'd slipped into, and he couldn't. He was getting weaker and weaker, and once again, he thought that death was coming, and in the book he describes those feelings again. But he says a moment or two later, something occurred which caused my wearied brain to be roused again into activity. What could it mean? I felt like one who'd had awakened out of a dream in the dead of night, conscious that someone or something was moving near him. Englishman! Kamerad! Great God, I thought to myself, I was found. Had I the strength, I would probably have screamed with joy. And then he thought that the Germans might kill him. Would it be a bullet or a bayonet thrust? And where would it strike me? And I lay perfectly still. He then realised that the German that had come to take him prisoner was actually helping him up. He was given a cigarette and taken on a stretcher to an aid station. He was given water and an injection against tetanus. Let's just think about that for a minute. About an hour earlier, he'd been shouting, kill, kill, about these Germans, and it was the same Germans now that were trying to save his life. One human being trying to save another human being. They are my words, my thoughts, not his. Over the next few days, he was transferred back through the German lines, and he ended up in a hospital in Hanover. He says, a woman came up to my stretcher with a basin of soup. I shall never forget that basin of soup. It was probably very ordinary soup, but when I tasted the first spoonful, I devoured it ravenously. For all the time, I had not realised that I was suffering from starvation. For the past 3 days, not an atom of food had passed my lips, and for 2 days previous to that, an occasional bite of bread and cheese was my only ration. And then comes one of those passages that I said at the beginning of the podcast makes this a different book, an extraordinary book, a remarkable book. I don't know what else, what other words to explain it. Because cautiously, he says, I began to feel my limbs, my arms, my body, my feet, my fingers. They were all there untouched. I was alive, he says. I sat up in my bed. I wanted to shout and dance for joy. There was a bandage round my head. I was blind. Yes, I knew that. There was nothing really the matter with me except that. The mere fact of being only blind seemed, in comparison, a luxury. I was blind, but joy indescribable. I was alive, alive. I never knew before that life was so wonderful. Did other people understand what life was? No, you must be dead to understand what life was worth. I must tell everyone how wonderful it all is. He then had the thoughts that would determine the rest of his life. He says how wonderful it is to die and then to come to life again. I'm only blind, just imagine it. What is that? It's nothing at all compared with life. And when I get well and strong, I won't be a blind man. I may not recover my sight, but that doesn't matter a bit. I will laugh at it, defy it. I will carry on as usual. I will overcome it and live the life that has been given back to me. I will be happy, happier than ever. I'm in bed alive. Oh God, I'm so grateful. And that's exactly what he did for the rest of his life. Achieved things in business, contributed so much to the sport and the community in Australia, in Sydney where he lived. As far as he was concerned, he'd come back from the dead and not been able to physically see with his eyes was of no importance to him. He hadn't finished either. He says, I was 36 years of age. What are my feelings? Even such a catastrophe doesn't appall me. I can no longer drive, run or follow any of the vigorous sports, the love for which is so insistent in a healthy manhood. I shall miss all of those things, yet I'm not depressed. Am I not better off, after all, than he who has been born blind? With the loss of my sight, I've become imbued with the gift of appreciation. What is my inconvenience compared with the affliction of being sightless from birth? For 36 years, I've become accustomed to sights of the world, and now, though blind, I can walk in the garden on a sunny day, and my imagination can see it and take in the picture. I can talk to my friends, knowing what they look like, and by their conversation read the expression on their faces. I can hear the traffic of a busy thoroughfare, and my mind will recognise the scene. I can even go to the play, hear the jokes and listen to the songs and music, and understand what's going on without experiencing that feeling of mystery, and wonder which must be the lot of him who has always been blind. And the greatest gift of all, my sense of gratitude, after passing through death, that I am alive. He keeps saying that, doesn't he? I am alive. I'm alive. I wonder whether we all take that for granted in the 21st century, over 100 years after the last men fell on the First World War battlefield. I certainly do. I have done. But I think reading this account is going to change the way that I live my life. When I looked at the battalion war diary into the official account of what happened, I discovered a list of casualties. And there was Gilbert Nobbs's name listed as being killed in action, neatly handwritten in the battalion diary. And that would have been fed back to company headquarters. And in due course, the War Office would have sent a letter or a telegram. And this is exactly what it said. Most deeply regret to inform you that Captain H.G. Nobbs of the London Regiment killed in action September the 9th. The King and Queen deeply regret the loss you and the Army have sustained in the death of Captain Nobbs in the service of his country. Their Majesties deeply sympathise with you in your sorrow. Letters followed from the front, other soldiers that had survived the onslaught confirming his death, and some of them even wrote to the family describing the manner of how he was killed. But he doesn't blame the War Office for this, he doesn't blame anyone for it. He says, think of the task of the hundreds and thousands of casualties and the errors, terrible though the suffering entailed may be, are comparatively insignificant. He says they thought me dead. Yes, killed in action. There was no getting away from it. No need for me to describe the tears and sorrow. Obituary notices appeared in the newspapers and letters and telegrams of condolence poured in. My solicitors took possession of my belongings and explained their contents to my family. Imagine the shock to his family when a postcard arrived from the German prisoner of war camp. He must have got someone to write it for him, perhaps one of the comrades in the hospital. Postcard had arrived at the family, and just imagine that scene when they get a postcard from beyond the grave, a grave that didn't exist, saying that Gilbert was still alive and was in hospital in a prisoner of war camp. His father wrote back to him quickly. He said, "My son, for 4 weeks we've mourned you as dead. God bless you." I wonder whether they celebrated at his home in London, but knowing, of course, that he was blind, I would have thought that any such celebration would have been somewhat muted. I have in front of me the battalion war diary. As I said earlier, it was very neatly handwritten by an officer, and he shows us that during the course of September, the casualties were absolutely enormous. The fighting strength of any battalion should be about 1,100, but when they went into action, their numbers were somewhat less than that, 700 or 800, I believe. But their casualties throughout September were absolutely enormous. They totaled 447. Between the 6th and the 10th of September, the period that Gilbert was there, the period that he got wounded in, it tells us that they lost 69 men killed, 257 wounded, and 25 missing. And on top of that, there are a list of officers, only 3 of them killed. And in amongst their number is Gilbert Nobbs, top of the list, killed on the 9th of September, it says. And of course, he wasn't killed at all. Lieutenant Sedgwick and Bantoff, they died of their wounds. And there are 6 other officers that were wounded on that dreadful day, the 9th. On top of that, Captain Charles, 2nd Lieutenants Collis and Wilkins were evacuated with shell shock. And we now turn to the end of his book. It's 240 pages long. And he says, "My story is drawing to a close. The hospital train, bearing its human freight, passed through Liège, Brussels and Antwerp to the Dutch frontier. All who could do looked so eagerly out of the window for the moment they should pass into freedom. The train stopped at a small station right on the frontier, and some formalities were gone through. It started again. There was a German sentry. There was a Dutch sentry. We were over. Hurrah! Cheer after cheer rang out from the long line of prostrate men. The train pulled up to a little station just across the border. The door of my carriage was flung open, and a number of Dutch girls came to my bed, and a shower of things came tumbling all about me as they passed one another, saying, 'Cigarettes, apples, cigar, cake, sweets.' I was in heaven. My story is told. I am back in my own home now, and as I conclude this record, the postman brings me a letter. It's from my solicitors. I've torn it open and find an account. The irony of fate closes the chapter to services rendered in connection with the death of Captain Nobbs." Much was to happen to Gilbert and his wife Catherine in the 54 years that followed. They remained married. They run that business that I mentioned at the start of the podcast. He was, as I said, rewarded by the British government for his efforts in business. He kept that promise to himself that he would enjoy life, and he died in 1970, 54 years after he was reported as being killed in action. What a man he was. How many other men with similar stories are out there that didn't write their memoirs that we don't know about? But one thing's for certain, I'll continue looking for them. And when I find them, I'll tell their stories in Tales from the Battlefields. So thank you once again for tuning in to my podcast. And as I've said before, it would be really useful if people could go on to Spotify or Apple, wherever they get the podcast from, and leave a review and a star rating. It does, so I'm told, help spread the word to other people so that we can tell more people about the stories of these unsung heroes from the Western Front and beyond. And we're going to play the last post today in memory of Gilbert Nobbs, who died 54 years ago now, and all of his comrades that died on that small corner of a French field.